Right, good morning everyone. Sorry, I was at the office, so I didn't hear how many people joined, but hopefully it's more than just Eric. I know Eric's there. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Duncan.
So what we wanted to do today was just really to set the scene a little bit for some of the presentations we'll be giving later on through the summer when we start to introduce some of the Release 11 stuff to you. And the idea really was to give an overview of the underlying architecture, or if you like, the way we'll be building applications for Release 11 of Fusion applications, and by implication, the kind of way that we expect our customers to be building applications as well. So this kind of provides that overview, and then in subsequent presentations, we'll obviously be drilling down into some of the technology and looking at what the actual implications of this stuff are. As a bit of a treat, I've managed to get some of the stuff working, actually, so we'll do a little sneak preview of some of the more interesting bits of technology as well later on in this presentation, just to make it a bit more interesting. So a lot of this will probably be familiar because it's really a story we've been talking about for the last couple of years. We've been obviously talking about Fusion. We've been talking about Fusion middleware. And then we've got kind of these three uses of the word fusion, which it's probably a good idea to understand what the contexts are. You have to forgive me here, I've got a bit of a cold this morning, so I'm croaking a bit, never mind. We've got the usage of the word fusion in three ways. First of all, the kind of stuff I'll be talking about today, which is the idea of fusion architecture, so our blueprint for what we would regard as modern applications. Then we've got Fusion middleware, which has been around for a little while as a general terminology to define the whole of the middleware suite. Obviously, the kind of underlying infrastructure that we see the architecture being based around. And then Fusion applications, as in eBusiness Suite, PeopleSoft, JD Edwards, and so on. And these are the guys who we're currently supporting right now, building the Fusion apps based on the Fusion architecture on the Fusion middleware. So it all comes together quite nicely. And then likewise, you've probably seen this picture before, but the idea here is really just to give you an overview of some of the components that make up the middleware suite and how it all kind of fits together. And I think the important point to make here, and this is really the big change, and we'll see this reflected again and again later on, the big change here is that we're dealing with a suite of middleware that provides a lot of infrastructure. You know, it's not basically about the kind of old job we used to do of generating some kind of UI based off database tables. That idea of an application is somewhat, should we say, old school, is the way I like to think of it. We're now dealing in a situation where we're working in a world where there's a lot of service consumption going on, and I'll explain that in a second. But also there's a lot of functionality within the core middleware engine that we can start to use within the applications we build. In the same way that, you know, for a long time the database has provided a lot of functionality beyond the basic job of getting data in and out of tables, you know, you've had things like job scheduling, you've had things like PL/SQL. You could do a lot more with the database than just persistence. And in the same way, you can... Hi, Peter. Are you in the web conference okay?
I'm getting there. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, that's okay. We're just doing through the preamble, so...
Okay.
It won't be anything too new. So saying it's much more than just hosting some kind of UI generation program. We're getting into a situation where the middleware suite can be hosting the infrastructure for things like instrumenting applications, for managing real-time metrics on usage, obviously things like identity management as a common service across the whole of the suite, and some of these other things like messaging, event-driven applications, and of course rules are things we'll cover as we go through. And of course, on the development tool side, we've got JDeveloper as kind of the core development environment for all of this lot. everything should be doable either from a runtime console, i.e. through Enterprise Manager, or through runtime customization, or it will be doable through JDeveloper. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of SOA, and really this is the pattern that's sparked all of the change. It's this idea kind of originally viewed in a fairly limited way in terms of just consuming web services, but the idea that we can look at business functions as a fairly granular piece of work and then treat those things as services with kind of a standardized way of discovering those services in the first place, then actually wiring those services up to our applications. And so the SOA architecture is all about taking those services and to think about your application in terms of loosely coupled services rather than as kind of tightly coupled functions. Now, you can see where we're coming from with this. If we look at something like the eBusiness Suite as, you know, a big monster beast, there's a lot of functionality within the suite which is shared by other areas of the suite. You know, we take something very simple like user provisioning. So that's a service which every single bit of the middleware suite, be it financials, be it HR, be it payables, you know, they're all going to need that functionality in one form or another. And of course, every group, because these things are written by different groups, it's a lot of developers out there doing this stuff, every group could be writing their own implementation, but that's obviously not a very productive or scalable way to work. And so this idea of, well, we can take bits of business functionality and treat those things as services, and then kind of pass those services around and consume them wherever we need to within the application. Now, this idea isn't new, of course. We've had attempts at this in the past. You know, we had the idea of, well, everything's an object, and we had CORBA, and the whole idea of request broking. And in the past, these attempts, if you like, have fallen down a bit because they were too tightly tied to two things, mainly proprietary APIs, because there were no real standards initially, and secondly, they were very much tied to particular operating systems. So we have things like distributed COM from Microsoft is, of course, very closely tied to Windows. So why SOA has really taken off is the realization that we really have all the standards and all the bits we now need to have a kind of truly agnostic way of describing things and of consuming things in using basically the web service APIs that we've now got. Because it goes beyond the simple job of discovering a service and wiring that into your application. There are also a lot of standards around the area of, well, how do I manage that service in terms of its level of uptime? Is it meeting my requirements for uptime? Is its response time quick enough? Can I pass my identity, my security credentials from my UI part of the application through to this back-end consuming service, even if I don't own the service? So there's a lot of standards around WS security and WS reliability which are there specifically to kind of help us in this very heterogeneous mixed environment of service consumption. So we can view services as pretty much anything. Now, I think it's unfair to say that SOA means web services. Of course, web services are a very good way of exposing a service in a public manner. But quite often when you've got a complex application which has pillars of functionality, then it's reasonable to expect that you may want to have services which are shared but only within the context of that application. So you may actually have services which are, to all intents and purposes, just PL SQL packages, right? They're still services. They're things that you can consume. You have a loose coupling. The actual implementation is transparent to the consumers. So we're not necessarily always talking about using the web service protocols as a way of consuming services. And in a lot of cases, particularly within an application, that could be a very inefficient way of working. So if we look at some of the key technologies on this, BIPL is a key example. Yes, it can wire up web services, and that's one of the major things it does. But it can also wire things much more directly. So it can wire directly into the database, or it can wire directly into a Java call. And for, you know, a lot of internal business functions, that's a much more scalable way of actually consuming those services, while still sticking to the basic idea of, yes, let's keep my application modular and granular. Sorry, and not too granular. So it's all really about, once you take this approach to thinking about applications in terms of these services, rather than, you know, traditionally you might think about your API to a part of an application being, you know, either directly the data structure you're writing to, i.e. the table, or maybe if you're a bit more sophisticated, the PL/SQL, kind of take a step back and say, well, okay, let's work up a level, and we have these higher level services for things like, you know, managing user provisioning. The advantages that give us is obviously, if things aren't too fine-grained, then you have to put a lot more thought in the design, which means if you've done it right, there's a lot more potential for reuse. Because your consumers aren't having to kind of work into the way that you work. You're having to build something that's generic enough so that all of your consumers can use you without having to know about your implementation. So there's obviously increased cost at the level of building the services if you know they're going to be widely consumed, but there's reduced cost in terms of consumption. So let's kind of start drilling in a bit and looking at what we've got within the middleware stack and what the implications are for how we're going to build applications, because this is really the interesting bit, if you like. So obviously within Fusion middleware today, we've got a whole bunch of built-in capabilities, obviously all the web services stuff which we need for this kind of server vision, Bipple and the Enterprise Service Bus. And these kind of components are all there specifically to manage these kind of service-based applications. So the basic web services functionality will allow us to publish the registry of our services. They'll provide all of the layering we need for these reliability and security functions. We can use the ESB to manage the job of, if you like, virtualizing services. So we can use ESB, the Enterprise Service Bus, as an interface to our application, and then within that we can dynamically work out, well, in fact, what service are we actually going to use for this particular piece of functionality. So this idea of virtualization is quite interesting, and it's a nice way of preventing kind of too much hard coding within our application, if you like. We can use this Enterprise Service Bus layer as a super abstraction layer, if you like. A lot of the service stuff we'll be talking about is going to be dealing within Beeple, so Business Process Execution Language. And there are some associated bits around Beeple which are very tightly integrated with it, which we'll see more and more, specifically human workflow. So this is things where we have things like approval chains and, you know, a mix of human and automatic tasks, which a lot of applications, particularly complex business applications, need. And this is an example of one of those bits of functionality which is now standardized within the platform rather than having to be built one-off for each application. And then we got the whole job of building a UI to kind of front all of this stuff. And so that's obviously where JDeveloper and ADF come in. And I'm sure you're all fairly familiar with that. But we'll talk about this in a bit more detail in a second. The final one, which again is really something we'll be using a lot within Fusion applications, and is one of those things that you may not particularly be that engaged with at the moment, but is this idea of using the middleware platform as a core integration point for your business analytics. So actually watching those applications as they run, both in terms of you know, the physical logistics of what's my CPU level like, am I going to have to add more servers, that kind of physical stuff, but also thinking about the applications you're running in terms of the business events that they're raising and interesting metrics from that point of view. So, you know, trivial things like monitoring stock levels, for example, or viewing trends. So this whole idea of real-time analytics across an application rather than kind of doing historical analysis through a data warehouse is a key kind of way forward with the middleware suite and, of course, Fusion applications. So let's drill down into, sorry, quick gulp of coffee, keep you going. Drill down into what Fusion apps will actually look like in terms of the kind of technologies they'll be consuming. So this is what I would call the old school view of the world, and this is the kind of application that we've been building for an awfully long time, and I've certainly been building for a long time in various technologies. We have what I call a very vertical view of the application. We've got basically a well-formed relational schema, and then the user interface, depending on which technology we're using, it's really a fairly close match to that schema. So this is very much the relational way of working, in that we, you know, get our data defined and designed right in the first instance, and then we can build applications fairly quickly on top of that, because having got the relational design right, the rest tends to fall out. So we have things like, you know, a forms application with its blocks based on tables. There's a fairly one-to-one match there. Likewise, if we look at, you know, some of the existing versions of the eBusiness suite, they also use the forms approach, and they'll also use business components with for relational mapping with UIX or maybe JSP for building front ends. But it's still very much that very vertical view of things. We have our tables, and then the UI really built directly on top of those tables. I mean, sure, you may have obviously a whole bunch of business logic in there. You will. Some of it will be in the form of PL/SQL packages in the database. Some of it will be local to either the business components tier or the forms tier. But the business logic that's involved there is really in support of the basic structure that's defined by the database schema itself. So that's how things were and largely are in a lot of customer sites. And this then is something that's a bit closer to where we see Fusion applications being. And this is really a direct, well, it's a simplification, but it's a direct image of the kind of thing that that Fusion apps are using today in the stuff they're building right now. So we still have that vertical slice in that we've got some kind of user interface, though nowadays we're using Java server faces for web deployed UIs. We're still using business components and all of the ADF stuff as the core of the data persistence, and there's still a database in the back. So that vertical stripe is still there, and that's still a very strong part of the application. But what's changed is that a lot of the workload is now being pushed off into other bits of functionality that are also supported by the middleware suite. So specifically, we see it here, business process execution language, we see human workflow, and we see rules. Now, if you look back, I don't know if you're familiar with the existing versions of the eBusiness suite, but these are bits of functionality that in eBusiness suite traditionally, and indeed within many customer applications, are there. The functionality is there, but they're implemented in terms of the customer's own custom code, right? So they've either got a workflow engine of their own, or they may have kind of a pseudo rules engine, either a bunch of hard-coded rules or something a bit more flexible. You look at applications, and again and again and again, we see these kind of patterns. And so what we're doing in Fusion Apps is recognizing that so much of that information, or sorry, so much of that functionality is common and can be expressed in a common way, and there are now standard ways to do that, that we can pull those things out as services within the middle tier, and then the developers can consume those services and configure them. So everyone's using the same infrastructure, basically. For the matter of building the UI part, of course, you're all familiar with ADF as a key strategy and a key part of Fusion. This doesn't change. The basic pattern is still one of, actually, let's go back a slide. The basic pattern is still one here of UI to database. So not, what we're not doing, and what we certainly wouldn't recommend to customers to do, is to go down the extreme of, well, if everything's a service, then we should base everything on web services. So all of our data persistence is done via web services, APIs, and so on. That, frankly, is crazy. You know, where it makes sense, we expose things as web services. Where they're needed outside of the context of my application, where they need to be semi-public or at least public within my organization. But for the basic job of getting data in and out of the databases, there are very efficient ways of doing that, particularly through business components. And so it makes sense to keep doing things that way. You know, and we'll often see, of course, people get very enthusiastic about technology and they'll jump straight in and say, well, okay, we're going to go direct for this SOA world. That means everything's a web service, right? So we'll do everything via web services. And of course, it will fail because it'll be just horribly inefficient. So ADF is still the key integration point from the point of view of building our UIs, either directly on database data or indeed using ADF as a way to wire into web services if we are consuming other applications, or functionality rather, from other applications. And of course, you'd be familiar that within the ADF world, we have a particular stack, which is the favored stack of Oracle applications, which is based around business components, obviously ADF binding, and then the use of JSF as the core UI technology. Now, one thing that we'll be seeing, I think I've got a slide on this in a second, is that within the business logic layer, the general pattern that applications will be using is not to actually access web services directly. So web services will always be wrapped up inside a business service application module, either in terms of calling out or consuming. And that just leaves them with a much more consistent approach to wiring into services. So all of the service provisioning or calling is done within the business logic layer rather than directly from the UI level. So we've got...
Duncan?
Yeah.
It's Peter. There's a question in the chat if we can break in and ask questions. It's kind of a small group. Is that okay?
Sure, yeah. I don't know how many we're actually on, but...
I think we got like 7.
Okay, yeah, let's break. Fire away.
Okay, this is Rizwan here. My question was that, fair enough, you did say that you are moving away from forms directly talking to the database to logic of using business services or ADF business components.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, how are we addressing the, in today's world, forms to the connection between the forms and the database, especially in the heavily transaction-oriented application that really gives a good framework or a good performance and scalability for us? How are we addressing that kind of a situation in this? How are we addressing that?
So let me get, is this, you mainly interested here in the kind of the data entry aspects or?
That's right, the more on a transaction-oriented system, because today the advantage of me having a form-based application is, obviously, if you really look at the e-business suite, I get such a great scalability using Oracle Forms talking to the Oracle database.
Right, sure. I mean, I should stress here that forms is still an option in this picture. I'm concentrating on the brave new world in terms of, you know, the main architecture that applications are using today. They will still be using forms for certain bits of functionality. It's going to be a long time before that gets moved out of the picture. And of course, forms will be there in 11. So, yeah, I know I can plead guilty to neglecting forms from this picture. Of course, one of the things we can do is kind of we can still use this pattern. We go back a couple of slides to the old school pattern. Where things change slightly, of course, is that particularly in release 11, and we can possibly, if we don't have a particular RD slot for this, we can certainly talk about it at one of the events where everyone's together. Within the forms world now, for the last few years, the key message has been to upgrade and integrate. And there's a lot of capability within forms now for wiring into these kind of heterogeneous server environments. So particularly things like using my forms in this instance and calling out to web services is a fairly trivial thing to do. However, what's even more interesting is within 11 we have the capability to subscribe forms into event queues as well. And so we can start to really live in this environment where we've got a mix of functionality. Some of it's within forms, some of it, for instance, maybe in human workflow. So you can see an environment where I've got some kind of front-end UI where someone's doing something, maybe placing an order. I've got a back-end UI which is based on forms. That form is subscribing to an event queue. When the order's placed in the UI, the kind of thin UI, that raises an event which triggers off a human workflow, which in turn raises another event which triggers in something in the form refreshes, and so on, right? So it's very much viewed as we would expect forms to still be about, but it would be living in this very heterogeneous world and would have all the hooks it needs to actually take part in these much more complicated transactions.
Can I ask a question about the database design? Because the way you're presenting it here, it's like you can do that the old way, so start with your relational data and then build your application, and then other applications will tap into that. But I think what's happening in a lot of environments is that a lot of data is duplicated because it's, you know, every application has its own schema and they all duplicate their customers, for example, or other data like that. So if you want to do a service-oriented architecture, you need to think about, you know, what's in your application and what you get from another one. So
right, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, this is kind of the point I was making earlier, that it becomes the job of designing those services. If you've got generic services, particularly like, you know, yes, user management or whatever, that becomes quite an important task to get that thing right if you want people to reuse it. I mean, it's like, it kind of harks back. You know, we come full circle. I remember, I don't know, 17 years ago or so, working at, before I joined Oracle, when I worked for the government, we had a guy whose job was to build the corporate entity model. And all he would do is to try and come up with a relational design that would work for the entire organization. Yeah. So, you know, a universal person table and a universal address table or whatever. And this was his life. And largely, I suppose, we've almost come full circle there in that we're trying to do the same thing again. We're trying to come up with services that are both generic enough to fulfill the need of multiple consumers, and yet at the same time can actually be useful. Right? I mean, that's always the problem. You can, particularly when trying to design generic stuff, you end up with potentially something which is so general that people have to go and extend it anyway to do anything that's really useful to them. So I agree. There's a slight emphasis on where the design has to go, and you do have to spend a bit more time thinking about these things. Now, the advantage is that when we're dealing with these things as a service, then at least then that's given us a layer of adaption or abstraction from the core data, so at least we're not having to come up with that corporate entity model. You know, we don't all have to agree on a definition of a customer. Yeah. We can have a customer service, and we can transform the inputs and outputs of that service via the various wiring levels if we need to. So in fact, all of my consumers don't have to agree on what a customer is. You know, they don't have to agree on address format because we can do some transformation within, say, BIPL or ESB to manage that. Now, from the point of view of within an organization, it makes sense to minimize that transformation because what you don't want to be doing is shuffling large amounts of data. You know, it's much better to pass a reference to someone's address than it is to pass their address and transform it from one format to another. The whole job of these architectural designs becomes somewhat trickier in these worlds. But I think the capabilities are there, so we can realize this vision. It just, a matter of realizing it efficiently, of course, is the big issue. Let's press on because we're running out of time, and I wanted to get to the metadata side because that's really, I think, the key thing to understand going forward, and also I've got a demo there, so that'll be nice. So this idea of, you know, whenever we're calling out to some kind of web service within the Oracle Applications Architecture anyway, those things will be fronted by a business components application module. So a typical scenario here may be I'm inputting an order. Now, when I input an order, several things need to happen. Obviously, I need to persist the order into the database, so I can do that just using conventional object relational mapping, using business components. But I also maybe want to then kick off some provisioning processes and some stock checking processes and credit checking processes. So we can use the eventing model within the middleware stack to do that, or we could call a web service directly to do that. There's a whole bunch of ways to do that. And what we're doing right now with Applications Division is actually trying to thrash out some of the best practices in this area. So specifically, if I want to kick off a business process as a a secondary function once I've committed my data, then the best way to do that is something that's still being experimented with. You know, we have about four different ways we could do it. So we'll update you on that when we decide, and we'll have that in the doc, of course. So you all know about business components, so I'll skip past that. When it comes to kind of the main wiring part of the whole architecture, Bipple plays a key part of this. So as going back to my earlier example of placing an order, you know, I've got several things I need to do. Some of those things can be done in parallel. Some of them need to be done linearly, so I need to complete them before I can continue. And we're actually building our kind of core demo for release 11 is built around this scenario, so I can kind of explain the scenario we've got, and that'll give you an idea of the kind of things that will go on there. So a customer places an order via kind of an Amazon-style UI. They go through the checkout. The checkout has some minimal validation associated with it, so we can obviously make sure that their credit card has got the right checksum and this kind of stuff. But we don't do a full credit check at that stage because the idea is to get a quicker checkout as possible. When they finish the checkout, so they essentially commit the data, at that stage the order is all committed into the database. So what we're not doing is we're not taking huge amounts of data and floating them around the system as XML documents. There's no point in doing that, right? All we need to do is set a status flag on the database table to say this order is not yet fulfilled or whatever its status is. But as soon as we commit, we also kick off an event which will invoke this Bipple process, and then the Bipple process will go through the more complex kind of back office functionality to actually carry out the order. So in this case, there'll be things like, obviously, checking the user is creditworthy and all the information supplied is correct in terms of the credit card isn't stolen and so on. Then it goes through a tender process, in fact, and will allow external suppliers to compete for some parts of that order. So this is transparent to the end user. They just ordered from us, but some bits of the order may be fulfilled from elsewhere. So this is where we're orchestrating several services in parallel to get the lowest bid and the quickest time to procure. Then once we've got all of the parts of the order confirmed, then there's an asynchronous process which will potentially go through an approval through human workflow, where the users will, depending on the type of user, what their past credit history is, what they've ordered in the past, we may have to approve or otherwise manage their order. So there are human interventions and UI associated with that. And this is all managed through the rules engine. So in fact, we're kind of pulling together all these bits. Let's go on past this. I'm conscious we're short on time. So for things like whether we should be carrying out human approvals and so on, and that's all done by rules within the rules engine, which define exactly the combination of circumstances under which an order can be processed automatically and where we need to do some kind of intervention. Then once we've gone through all of that and everything's approved, then finally the actual order fulfillment is submitted, and then that goes off into another process via the ESB, which will manage the provisioning and shipping of that thing. Throughout the whole life cycle of that kind of process, there's a continual feedback into the application. So we have various events being raised, so we know at what stage the order is actually at. So the client UI can be updated with status information about the order, you know, whether it's being picked, shipped, or otherwise processed. And at the same time, if we're wired into some kind of BAM console, then the real-time stats for the kind of management view of the application are also being updated and monitored, so we can keep an eye on, you know, what particular items are selling very well, what items are getting low on stock. So all of these kind of back-end business functions that are really key to keeping the business going but aren't directly of impact to the end user using the UI. So that kind of model of interaction where we're using all of these bits, obviously the straight relational mapping, but then calling out to Bipple to do these more complex asynchronous and parallel flows. We're using the human workflow engine to manage workflow queues and so on where we've got some human intervention involved potentially, and the rules engine to kind of tie all of those things together. This is pretty much the normal pattern that you'll see going forward into Fusion applications. And some of the key design decisions that we've been making here relate into the way that some of these things are wired together. So a good example of this is the rules engine, right? So potentially, I could be using the rules engine at a very granular level. I could be wiring up triggers, if you like, you know, as I tab between fields in my UI or as I submit a page in my UI, I could be calling out to the rules engine to do various bits of evaluation at that stage. We've experimented with that, but it turns out not to be a great idea because that's, you know, a fairly heavy activity. You know, the rules engines aren't something you just start up and stop for the sake of it. So you'll see rules mostly used in this kind of back-end scenario where they're being consumed by the service layer as part of that service provisioning engine rather than being called directly from the UI. So these are the kind of things we're trying to flesh out right now and get into the best practice guides for the Release 11 development. And you'll see a lot of that kind of design decision in there. And of course, it'll be up to you as to whether you want to follow similar patterns or whether you want to kind of wire things in more directly and see what happens. But we've been doing a fair amount of testing, so hopefully we've got it right. I'm running out of time, so what I wanted to do was quickly jump on a little bit to get here. I can persuade this to display the right page, which I haven't. Escape from there. And just spend a few minutes focusing on MDS. And this really is a key point to understand. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard about MDS before. We've been talking about it in a low-key way for a while. But really in Release 11 is the first place you'll see how it can really help you. So the kind of core design decision through a lot of the stack that we're using in Fusion applications is based around the idea that as much of the application should be declarative as possible. Okay, so we've got a lot of frameworks out there. We've got ADF, which is all declarative. or mostly declarative in the core functionality. Obviously, you had to add code as well, but you know the core functions are declarative. We've got people, which again is declarative. It's just an XML document. We got the rules stuff, which again is just an XML document. All of these things can be defined in metadata, generally XML. We have the issue of how do we manage that, if at all, and once we do manage it, what can we do with it? So within JDeveloper since 10.1.3, in fact, we've had a metadata services layer within ADF. It's something that hasn't really been exposed at all. You don't see it. It's just the internal APIs that we use. So when you change you know, a struts page flow diagram or a JSF document, the actual underlying persistence of that document within the IDE goes via MDS. And that will sound very unexciting. This is just an internal API and it means nothing. But the idea really is that MDS can go much further than that. And in 11, you'll begin to see that comes to the surface. There is some MDS out there today, and that's in the form of Web Center. And so Web Center uses MDS to store its metadata, both its design time and runtime metadata. And so when you're doing customization within MDS at runtime, within Web Center at runtime, that's also using the MDS APIs.
Is there a standard for this, or is it Oracle specific?
No, this is Oracle specific right now. I mean, MDS is based around an adapter mechanism. So we've got the idea of, okay, we've got all of these different providers of metadata, struts, JSF, JSP, Bipple, whatever, right? You name it, everything provides some kind of XML metadata nowadays, Spring, right?
Yeah.
And we've got this layer which will act as a universal adapter and manage how that metadata is stored, so trivially to the file system on kind of a write-through, but also it could use the database, and indeed in the Web Center case does. But what's interesting is what we can do with it once we've got it. So here's pretty much where we are today, where we've got kind of MDS as a core piece of infrastructure, but you don't really see it. But where we're going in the future is, well, once we've got a canonical representation of the metadata that essentially defines the application, we can start to manipulate that metadata either at kind of install time or indeed at runtime. So this is kind of taking the idea that we've had for a long time in portals that the application can be customized by the end consumer to provide the view that they want. We can take that and go one stage further and use this as a universal mechanism for adding both customization and personalization on top of applications. So the idea is I can build my application. I'm using MDS as the underlying infrastructure to manage its metadata. I can deploy that application to my customers. My customers can go in there and they can make changes to the app. But what actually happens is they don't really change the application. Instead, they're layering on diffs or deltas on top of the metadata. And so when they run, MDS at runtime will efficiently manage that process and serve them up the view of the application as they've customized it. But in reality, what they're actually seeing is a combination of the base application plus their changes. And what that means is that I can then go in and deploy a new version of my application to that same customer. They've not actually changed my core metadata. So my application can be upgraded, and provided they've done changes which aren't, you know, say for instance we're dealing with a business object here, providing that business object hasn't fundamentally changed, their customizations will just continue to work on top of that object. So the idea here really is to break out of the whole idea of as soon as I customize my application, I'm then kind of wired into my own specific version. I can never go back to the version shipped from the vendor. And this is obviously really useful for folks who are building their own packaged apps that they want to resell and sell in a customized form but allow kind of safe customization. Or indeed, within an organization where you've got lots of consumers, where those consumers may want to provide some level of customization. So a good example of this is I was down at Apple in Cupertino a couple of weeks ago talking to their folks who write their help desk systems. So these are the guys that sit at the end of the phone answering questions about your iPod. They have a system that only works for iPods for some strange reason, and the guys in the laptop division want to use the same thing, but they want it slightly different. So even within an organization, they could apply the same techniques to provide a single core application and then allow different departments to have a customized view of that. So here's kind of the simple example of it. We've got a base document. I apply customization, maybe several levels of customization and personalization, and then the end user sees the kind of results of that. What I'm going to do is actually quickly, we've got 5 minutes left, I'm going to actually switch to JDeveloper and show you this because it's a lot clearer when you actually see it in action. So let's just get rid of that second and we'll bring up release 11 of JDeveloper. When you start release 11 of JDeveloper, one of the first things you'll see is this role screen. The default role is the ordinary development role that we'll mostly be using. There's some specific roles for other types of audience as well. But the interesting one is the customization developer. So I choose that role. What that's going to do is start JDeveloper up in a special way. So rather than when I edit a document, for instance, a JSPX page or a business components entity object, rather than physically changing that core document or core piece of metadata, instead, MDS will start to record the diffs for me. So it'll start to record these customizations. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, you've got your packaged application. You go to a customer site. They want it installed. You install it. You would then go into this mode and start to tweak the application to their requirements. Forgive me while JDriver 11 just gives me a few errors because it's a nightly build. Right, so I'm in customization mode, and just for simplicity, we'll do some edits to this page. This is just a very simple login page. And what's happened here? I don't see my customization. Bear with me. Okay, this demo is a lot shorter than I expected. Let's try again. This naturally worked just before I came on the phone, but we'll see if the demo gods are with us. Okay, it's building the UI now. Okay, let's see if we can view our customizations. Hooray, okay, it's working this time. So what we've got here is the idea that we can define levels of customization for my application. In this particular case, I've defined two levels of customization, industry and site. These are arbitrary names, right? So, and within each one, I can have multiple values. So for instance, I've got the household goods industry, and then at the site level, I've got Walmart, Kitchen Closet and Beyond, and so on. So I can apply customizations at any one of these levels, and then they're kind of cumulative. So if I go into switching just to industry level customization for household goods, I might, for example, pull in a new output text item and drop that somewhere. Where can I put that? Let's put that there. And go in and set the value. So in this case, I'm doing a piece of UI just for simplicity. Right, so we've got a little bit of UI. Then I might go in and change my focus. So now I'm going to go down to the site level and maybe for Walmart, go into this username field and change one of its properties. Your Walmart customer ID. So I've got two customizations made to this page at different levels. Now what that's actually done for me is created some specific XML diffs. So if we look at one of these can either be persisted to the file system or more usually to the MDS repository, because these things may be versioned as well. We can see here what we've actually got is, in this case, an insert before the JUsename field, a component of this type with a particular value. And at the site level, I've got another similar document which is showing the modification of the JUsername field. Right? If I go in and change my site to something else, say Kitchen Closet and Beyond, and reopen the page, you'll see I've still got my generic industry-level customization, Welcome to Our Shopping Portal, but the username is still the base document because I've changed my context for that site-level customization. So I might, for instance, go into this new item here and change this KCB shopping portal. Right? So you can see here how I'm layering customizations on top of the base document, but the base document isn't actually being changed. If you were to look at that on disk, it would be identical to the initial thing I shipped. But what I'm doing is generating up these diffs. And these can be applied for any kind of XML metadata, because everything works via the MDS layer. So be it rules from a rules engine, be it BIPL flow, business components definition, UI like this, data binding, all of that stuff. So I can even data bind onto this page, and all of the diffs that are generated as a result of that will be stored as these MDS deltas. Right. And so this is then kind of a key part of the whole strategy going forward, in that obviously a big requirement for Oracle applications is to have something that can be customized on site, potentially vertically for an industry, then for a particular site, and then maybe for even departments within a site, and they can define these multiple levels of customization. And then at runtime, everything is resolved based on whatever configuration I'm running in, so I can pick up and merge the correct metadata in. And then finally, we can add personalization on top of this as well. So if you have a web center or portal-like UI where the user can physically customize the screen at runtime, then that will use MDS as the same mechanism to do that as well. And it's key to understand that we do this in a highly efficient, very scalable way. A lot of the work we've been doing in 11 is to make sure this is working as fast as possible with as much caching and so on as possible. But I just wanted to show you that because it's really a key concept of where we're going moving forward with Fusion Apps.
Is there going to be some way to test or simulate the results? Because you can add a lot of, you know, things that can end up in errors, I think.
Well, basically, the IDE will only let you, when you're in this customization mode, it's only going to allow you to edit stuff you can edit, right? So it'll only allow you to make metadata changes. And because you're doing that through the ordinary editors, everything you do will result in valid documents, right? So if I change the data binding, now obviously there are going to be situations where I've got to be careful, right? So if I've got something like I change a view object to add an extra attribute, and then bind that attribute into the UI, I will obviously have to do both parts of that. But there again, I would never see that attribute available to me unless I'd already done the first part. And that's the advantage of switching the whole IDE into this mode, in that I'm forced to do things in a valid way. So I can't consume data that's not yet available, because if it's not yet available, I can't see it in order to consume it. Yeah. So it should be fairly self-controllable. Now, obviously, where things get interesting is where people try and hack the metadata diffs themselves. But, of course, you wouldn't do that, would you, Loniki?
Of course not, Duncan.
But I think it's a really cool feature. And the nice thing, of course, is that we can... this stuff's kind of all configured through a little configuration class, and I can run the application and just switch between modes and see the results of the customization for the different levels of site and industry in this case.
And I think it's very cool too. I'm working on an application where they try to build that themselves with the PL/SQL and forms.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, I think. But the same problem they have, I imagine that you might end up here, is that they have no way of testing the application because there are so many configurations that clients can run, and you know, with the combination of business rules and UI and stuff like that, it gets hard to predict how the application is going to behave after it's customized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the, I think the big problems with anything like this kind of architecture is just that there are so many moving parts, and you've got different testing technologies for different things as well, which doesn't help.
Yeah.
I think that's a very valid thing to point out. So we're working on testing regimes and best practices as well. But that stuff isn't ready yet, but we'll be able to talk about some of that in the future. But I agree that it's always a risk. As soon as people start customizing an application, they can start to potentially break it. Because we're kind of confining the customization at the metadata level, there's less chance of breakage, right? In that, you know, we'll always have well-formed documents. There won't be syntactical breakages. There may be logical breakages. I mean, that's always a risk, particularly in things like customizing rules or BIPL flows. They could easily make a mistake and mean that under certain circumstances something never actually ever happens or whatever. And it's a valid point. So there's lots of good presentations that people can do about how to work in this world, right?
Yeah.
After we understand it.
Yeah.
After we have a tool that we can understand it with.
Yes. Right. So that'll be coming soon, don't worry.
Yes.
So how do you manage all the customizations? Is there a viewer or something that you can, you know?
Well, you'll notice here that when I'm in this mode, I'm seeing the customizations as they are. So I'm seeing the compound document here in the UI.
Yeah, but now you only have one version, right? So it's
right, so I can
relatively simple.
Well, yeah, but I can switch between my customizations, right? So I can go back to Amazon.com, for example. Now, at the moment, the refresh isn't working in this build. I don't think I may have to close and reopen the page. Yeah. So I reopen the page. So I've gone back to that base industry customization and no site customization. So,
okay, but say that somebody calls the help desk and then you want to know what customization they're running, right? So otherwise you
right.
Don't know.
Well, you've got to remember that this is designed to be fairly granular. So, you know, I've got my application and I deploy it to a particular customer. That customer will have certain customizations. Oh, right, so I get your point. Yeah, if that customer then calls in and
exactly,
says...
Exactly,
yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. So one of the things that potentially you want to be able to do is to lock down what they can play with. So adding screen UI is probably reasonably safe, but other things may be slightly more complicated. Yeah, I think, but this is, as you say, this is something that if it isn't provided in this mechanism, people will have to write anyway, okay? So either they have to have some kind of rules or author that's specific to the application, or the people go in and customize code directly. You know, there's always this need for customization. You know, we can pretend that people should never customize packaged applications, but we know that's not the case. And I think this is a much more controlled form of customization than anything we've ever had before. So it's certainly, you know, a step forward in that respect. I think you'll always have that issue of is my version of the application the same as yours? Particularly when we start to look at things like, well, my customizations themselves can be versioned, right? So I might have version 1.1 of the Walmart customization rolled out to all of my sites, but I'm currently trialing version 1.2 on 3 sites, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right to highlight it's a very complex area. Okay, I think we're about over time, aren't we? So.
Yes. Thank you, Duncan. I'm actually just going to end the recording, and I will post this recording. I noticed that your slides were internal. Are those, we'll still obviously be able to post those for the...
Sorry. These are ones I put together for applications, but I thought I could just share them with you anyway, so I will, I'll remove that bit and we can, they'll be the same.
Okay.
I'll just take the apps internal bit off.
Fantastic. All right, thank you very much.
Okay.